Grillam, two podcasts in 2 days, mate. How are you? Is it making you flag a wee bit?
Well, no, I'm rolling. I've got so much. No, I haven't got any banter at all. I'm quite nervous about that. We can talk about tortoises.
We did over banter yesterday, didn't we? So Albert's in. He's I had to we left it slightly too long. We left him a week longer at the garden, just because it had been so mild.
Climate change.
And then couldn't find him. So I did have to spend a Saturday a week ago just going around the garden gently with a fork, digging over his usual haunts just to see if I could excavate him.
Garden fork or a little cutlery fork?
No, just one of those little sort of forky things that you use for doing
Tortoises. A tortoise fork.
tortoises. Yeah, a tortoise fork. A
Sorry.
tortoise. Of course, there's a tortoise fork. If there isn't, someone should invent one.
It's only about that time. Don't. Well, we need to edit that out until because it's disclosure.
Yeah, disclosure.
Right,
Yeah,
don't.
I always forget about the disclosure bit. You'd think after, what was it, 11, 12 years, I'd have got that by now, wouldn't you? But
Yeah, right.
yeah,
It's out now. And
but...
so you obviously found it. How much of a Saturday did you spend looking for a tortoise with a
Oh, it's
fork?
about 3 hours it took me.
Really?
Yeah, it's got, we've got quite a big garden, and he's got quite a few haunts that he likes to hide in. And this time around, he had chosen a different one. So he'd chosen somewhere he had never hidden before. I was getting quite worried, because the worry is, of course, once the nighttime temperatures drop below freezing, he'll freeze. And unfortunately for tortoises, that's it. They've got no way of regulating their body temperature, so they match the environment,
Okay, that's good.
and you don't want them to freeze. So it was important to find him just before the weather really turned. But yeah, no, found him. He was about 3 foot down. He had gone really deep.
See, tortoises are a mole.
He was a long way down. He had gone under a tree root and all sorts. But yeah, no, I found him, and so he's back in the house. Took a little bit of washing off. He was quite muddy.
You got a 3-foot-long tortoise fork.
No, I had to dig quite a hole. It may not have been three. It may not have been 3 foot. I may have been exaggerating there, but it was quite a long way down for a tortoise.
Anyone come out and say, Dad, why are you digging a 3-foot hole with a tiny
Yeah,
fork?
I've now just realised how deep 3 foot is, and yeah, no, he probably wasn't that far
It's a
down.
meter. Good.
Yeah, no, but he's indoors, cooling down, and then he'll go in the purpose-made fridge down the garage in about a couple of weeks' time.
What's the fridge?
For tortoise fridge for about 3 months, and then we'll get him out again in time for podcasting next year. So don't worry.
Sounds good. Doing it
Hey,
return to the tortoise.
we've got a proper sciencey podcast today. How exciting is that? Because we've not done a real science one for ages, haven't we?
I love science.
Yeah, not with people who know science and know what they're talking about.
Scary, yeah.
So we've got the Society of Chemical Industry on, SCI, and we'll introduce our guests in a moment. Just a heads up, I got really excited a few years ago because when we were looking for an office move, one of our options was to go to SCI. But of course, our council members are quite conservative when it comes to council meetings, and they like them to be in a particular place. And SCI are over in Belgravia, and at that time we thought that was just slightly too far to go for council meetings. So how sad is that? Otherwise, we could have been cohabiting with SCI and not where we are now.
We've been podcasting from there.
We would have been podcasting from there. Yeah.
Lee Davis and Gwilym Roberts are the two IPs in a pod, and you are listening to a podcast on intellectual property brought to you by the Chartered Institute of Patent Attorneys.
So let's get them on. Sharon, shall we start with you? Do you want to introduce yourself to our listeners?
Yes. Hello, Lee. Hello, Gwilym. Nice to meet you. I'm Sharon Todd. You absolutely should have taken that offer up, by the way, and then we
We
would
should.
be doing this in Belgrave Square, or perhaps in the science garden at the back of Belgrave Square. So I have the pleasure to be the chief executive of an organisation called SCI, which I'll introduce in a minute, Lee. But my background is I am a chemist by training, but I spent 30 years of my career in industry, in various industry roles, running businesses and divisions of large companies, and also in what we would call mergers and acquisitions work, which is buying and selling of businesses and companies as well. Came to SCI in 2016, originally on a 6-month interim project to help support the charity as it was reshaping, and I find myself still here several years later, but we'll come on to talk about why in a minute.
Cool. And we've also got Charlotte with us. Charlotte, introduce yourself.
Hi, I'm Charlotte Crowhurst. I'm also a chemist by training, but I'm a partner at Potter Clarkson, and in my spare time, I'm also a trustee of the SCI. I've been a trustee for about 5 years now.
Yep.
Cool. Well, thanks. You're both really welcome. And I know we've got all sorts that that we can talk about. Where I'd quite like to start is to understand a little bit about SCI, how it started, its history, the sorts of things it's up to. And I know then we want to move on to this really exciting manifesto that you've recently launched. The interesting thing is, of course, we share pretty much a founding period. We were founded in, so SEPA, 1882, SCI, I know because I looked it up this morning, 1881. If you look at some of those early people, they were the same kinds of people doing the same sorts of interesting stuff around science and innovation at that time. It's exciting to be doing this podcast because we have that deep in the dark midst of time, that shared history. So, Sharon, tell us all about it.
Yeah, Lee, fortunately, you've just got me onto my specialist subjects. You'll have to stop me if I take about 30 minutes or 40 minutes to introduce SCI. But SCI is a charity. We were established, as you quite rightly point out, in 1881. Feels like an awful long time ago for us, doesn't it? And it's effectively an industrial innovation hub, which connects up industry, academia, and government to accelerate science-based solutions out of the lab into industry for the benefit of society. So our community work on the sort of big societal challenges of the day. And of course, in 1881, those were about maybe food poverty. They were about health and life longevity, you know, and since that time, there's been a significant emergence of new products and benefits for society that we see today, and obviously the booming population that we have today. So our founders were really interesting. I think they were quite eclectic because it's quite a unique organization with a very strange purpose, a very relevant purpose. But I kind of view them almost like a sort of Silicon Valley of the day, really, because they were scientists, they were inventors, what we call inventors, so people that make, well, you'll know this very well at SIPA, but people that make the physical products and processes, and entrepreneurs. And many went on to form large companies of the last industrial revolution. So people like William Lever of Unilever today, Dr. Siemens, who people think they're a German family, but they've long had a British presence, and many other sort of members that I think people would, you know, recognize today in companies today. So our community today is a combination of large and small companies and startups, academics, government, patent lawyers like Charlotte, and anybody who's really involved, a practitioner and involved with taking science out of the lab into industry for the benefit of society. So our community today has over $500 billion in sales around the world. It invests over $30 billion, so there's some big numbers here, in what we would call research and development, scientific research and development. And we also host, you know, hundreds of startups. We publish translational research, so that's coming from academia. And we also support the next generation of scientists and inventors and entrepreneurs. Really critical that we have that kind of community coming forward. So effectively, you know, we'll talk about the manifesto in a minute, but our community is effectively working on, you know, addressing and providing scientific solutions to the big challenges of today around climate change, around renewable energy, around global health and wellness, and around sustainability as well.
Fantastic. And you're so is it a mixed membership economy? Do you have organizations and individuals?
Correct. It's a mixed membership economy, a membership model. It's an open membership model. So that's sometimes quite unusual with other organizations, probably like yourself. It's kind of very much a professional organization. I think our purpose was quite different. You know, we work a lot with different organizations, but our purpose is quite unique. And for that, you know, in order to deliver that purpose, we have an open membership model so people can come and engage. And that brings real breadth and depth to it. So we have scientists from Gwilym, you'd be pleased to know, we have physicists in the system, we have environmental scientists, we have food scientists, we have horticulturalists. People say to me, why have you got horticulturalists? I'm like, well, of course, is it not obvious? You know, we need to combine all of this expertise, all of this knowledge, and convene it and put it together in a way that really helps transfer that knowledge between different people and accelerate some of these solutions that we see today.
Cool. And Charlotte, you're wrong. Did you say you were a trustee? Forgive me, I forget how you introduced
yourself. Yeah, I'm a trustee. So there's a fair number of us trustees who we meet about four or five times a year and just oversee what's going on in the society.
I'm very envious of a trustee board that meets four or five times a year. I have a council that meets once a month, whether it needs to or not. And And we put the patent world to rights regularly on a monthly basis. It's great. It's great fun. I work with her. You'll know this, Charlotte, from your experience at SCI. Volunteers are infectious people in the best possible way. I don't mean they carry nasty diseases or anything. They're just brilliant people to work with in terms of the energy and the enthusiasm they bring.
I think that's a really important point, Lee. You know, you and I see it, don't we, in the organisations that we run. And I don't think it's well recognised, you know, in the community at large, the huge amount of time and energy a lot of these volunteers give into really driving things forward that are about the broader benefits for society. And I you know, you see lots of charities, we do as well, in our space, in science, in business, you know, and there's a huge amount of people. If I added up the amount of time our volunteers spend on, you know, we've got committees working on renewable energy, on sustainable materials, on, you know, we've got some early careers committees, mid-careers committees, you know, there's lots and lots of people engaged in different ways around the society. And if you added up the huge amount of time and energy they give, it's vast. It's absolutely vast.
Yeah, it's an extraordinary contribution they make. And it's similar to you. I mean, we have about 20 committees that sit under council. That they could be committees ranging from our laws committee, so patents, copyright, design, trademarks, or our sort of more subject interest, life sciences, or just the running of SEPA. We have a public affairs committee and international liaison committee. And you're right, the time that people put into, I mean, Grillham is an example of this. He does the podcast with me. He's a member of council. He's our honorary secretary. He sits on a number of committees. Genuinely, Grillham, I don't know how you and people like Charlotte find the time. How do you find the time to do all of this volunteering?
Well, very quickly, for me, I just make sure I do what I enjoy doing, and I also dip in when I think I can be useful and keep my head down when I can't. So I'm quite careful not to sit in and be volunteer when I'm not any use. But it's not my podcast. Charlotte, how much time do you spend on this? What do you find yourself doing?
Well, I mean, as well as the Board of Trustees, which has various half day meetings a few times a year, I also sit on a couple of other SCI committees, the Food Science Committee and the Science and Enterprise Committee. So we also get involved in running events and perhaps speaking at events as well. So yeah, it can be quite hard to fit it all in. Sometimes you just have to say, right, I'm going to stop doing what I'm doing. I've really got to do this. And as we all know, it ends up, you end up often doing these things out of normal working hours.
The great thing about the new regulatory arrangements that we've got that have just been put in place, is just for Sharon and other listeners' benefit, our regulator, IPREG, has just put in place revised regulatory arrangements, and they've changed very much what CPD looks like to be more individually focused. So everything you do in SCI now counts towards your CPD. How cool is that?
Yeah, that's great. And there's some things I particularly like doing, like the SCI runs a student competition every year called Bright's Idea, which we have student teams, often undergraduate teams, pitching an idea that could change the world, and giving some overviews of IP and talking to these entrepreneurial youngsters is one of the things I really enjoy most about my roles at SCI.
Now, that's quite an important point, I guess. I know we're going to move on to the manifesto, but that kind of mentoring, Lee, that the volunteers give, you know, the experienced volunteers to the, you know, younger generation coming through, that kind of mentoring and that transference of their experience is hugely valuable. It's a soft thing, and it's great to hear that CPD is recognising that. But I know you've got the same kind of programmes in SIPA, but I think that's a really important thing that's not often recognised, you know, as well, that transfer of knowledge and experience.
So how do we segue into the manifesto then? I mean, we had this conversation a few weeks back, didn't we? I think Charlotte approached SIPA and said, would you guys be interested in this piece of work that we're doing? So, do you want to just set the scene for us?
Yeah, sure. So we've been doing a piece of work with the board over the last 2 years around the strategy at SCI. The benefit for charities is that we have a charitable purpose, which is laid down. And so there's not a lot of, I guess, debate about what you're there to do, but we need to interpret the purpose for today's, you know, for where we are today. So we went back to the charter, we looked at that, we looked at, you know, what are the big societal needs of today, and developed an updated strategy, really looking at the big societal challenges across climate and planet, and health and wellness. However, alongside that, unique in our charitable purpose is this kind of concept of accelerating science out of the lab and into industry. And I guess we saw a very good example of that in a sad circumstance around COVID. You know, the development of the COVID vaccine, which typically would have taken 20 years to have done, in an intense environment of need, drove people to collaborate, drove regulators to move quickly and governments to move quickly. And there was, you know, a great example of how we can accelerate things if we work together. So that's kind of a bit of a background and sort of scene setting. And so we've been working on the sort of process of accelerating science out of the lab. It's not well known. Again, I know your listeners will know this very well, but broadly, it's not very well known that science businesses take a long time to develop and scale. They take a long time to come to market. They need a big patent portfolio, which you guys will be helping them with. They need a lot of cash. And often they take, you know, 5, 10, sometimes 15 years before they turn a profit. And that's fundamentally very different from, say, a tech business that could be started in somebody's backyard. And in a year or 2 years, they could be potentially billionaires. And I think we feel quite strongly within our community that the need to support science out of the lab needs an understanding of this process and needs interventions that will really help drive the science forward in a much quicker way. So we did a piece of work which was very UK focused because we didn't want to be too far, spread too far. So we started in the UK and we did a piece of work with LEK Consulting in April, May time this year and asked them just to look at the market and what was happening. You know, were we leading edge? Where were we? Because the UK obviously has a very strong science sort of academy base. You know, we've got 4 of the top 10 universities in the world. We've got an extensive innovation ecosystem and a long history of strong science in the UK. And the LEK report, basically the nuts and bolts of the output, basically said we're really not doing well enough. There's quite a few things that need to be fixed, quite a few interventions that need to be made on this journey of getting science out of the lab through industry for the benefit of society. So they developed a sort of, I guess, a dashboard, which looked at a series of areas across starting up through. So that might be, for example, launching out of a university. So tech starting out of a university into what we would call scale up. So that's kind of, you know, going from a 500 gram scale in the lab up to, you know, a kiloton, for example, and then into full scale manufacture. And that really helped us to do two things. It developed the essence of the manifesto, which has highlighted the opportunity that could come to the UK and to society if we developed a more comprehensive and long-term commitment to supporting these startups coming out of the lab and also large-scale investment. And they identified an opportunity of 230 billion in additional GVA and an additional 240,000 jobs across the life sciences, biotech and clean tech sectors if we could get everything working effectively. Obviously, those are big numbers. And the big numbers because there is big opportunity in these markets. There's certainly big opportunity. And the societal value or the societal benefit comes in not only jobs, you know, but also in corporation taxes in the UK. It comes in companies investing back into the science ecosystem, for example, at universities. And obviously, you know, the concept of bringing solutions much quicker to society, whether they're in the UK or around the world, that, you know, that doesn't matter. So the policy interventions are several fold and are really built around, you know, how can we turn the dial on some of these areas and move them forward? I can move on into a couple of them if you'd like me to, or do you want me just to stop there?
Oh, Gwen wants to come in.
Sure.
Oh, go on. I'll let you speak, mate.
Oh, thank you. Honestly, normally I just have to nod when he talks about his blooming daughters. I think actually just before we kind of get into a bit more detail, because it sounds amazing, but I'm sort of thinking as my other hat as a SEPA person, as I'm a member of SEPA, I'm a patent attorney like Charlotte is, and we're in the firm and we pay our subs to SEPA and we know what we get. We get some kind of, we get lots of support, SEPA lobbies in the right places, it helps coordinate all kinds of stuff. It's good for the profession, it's kind of essential. Sounds to me like it's a bit more, it's a little bit more discretionary by the sound of it to be a subscriber or a member of your organization. and I can really see some of the reasons they do it, but there's a very strong philanthropic element to it by the sound of it. What do you think brings your members to you and keeps them paying their subs?
Great question, because I've mused that since I've been in this role. Obviously, as you say, a lot of other organisations, it's part of their professional development, and sometimes in the case of engineers, you know, requirement for chartership, for example. I genuinely think, Willem, it's a passion for what they're doing. I genuinely think, you know, there's a huge amount of passion at SCI. I think people fundamentally believe that collaboration is good for society, and that's why they gift their time, because there is very little recognition per se from a kind of employer the employers support the work. But yeah, I genuinely think there's a real passion for the work they do and an understanding of the value of collaboration.
Hence the drive for a manifesto, I suppose, to say
exactly
this is what your collaboration brings.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think what's interesting about the manifesto, Willem, there, just to link back to SIPA, is it's actually been interesting as we've launched. We launched in August and have been busy sort of working away on it. But I think what's been interesting is the engagement with other core stakeholders. You know, we would regard the patent attorney community to be a core stakeholder group in this conversation. You know, they are a key enabler for these startups, you know, the expertise that you bring and how you help the companies as they go forward. And I think that's just a really interesting, perhaps a side that I hadn't really recognized as we launched. You know, there are multiple stakeholders here. There are the funders. We've been talking to the British Business Bank and Venture Capital, obviously the universities and the companies themselves. But, you know, this is a broad conversation we need to be having. And I think we feel in SCI very strongly we need to be having it now. We're not addressing the climate change targets in a way that needs to be done. I think there's starting to, I think there's a general public awareness that's starting to emerge that these things are complex. And again, we know this very well, but you know, changing your base science in core products is not straightforward. And there are all sorts of implications of that. So I think the more we can reach out and work with each other and collaborate across the stakeholder group, I see that as one of perhaps the real benefits of this manifesto.
Can I pop a question at this point, Sharon?
Sure.
And it's linked to something that you said there. So SIPA's just been involved for 2 years in quite a intensive campaign around the UK's international trade negotiations and what the impact that might have on the patent attorney profession. And long story short, we got a great outcome, but it took 2 years of really, really hard work. In terms of where you see the manifesto going and how you need to see that develop, is the political environment helpful at the moment? I'm guessing maybe not as much as it might be.
Yeah, I don't want to politicise this because we're not a political organisation, yeah. But I think in one way we see the current environment being an opportunity because there's an election coming and it's given us an opportunity to launch a manifesto and to talk about what we believe passionately about and to engage others. And it's almost allowed that conversation to happen and to grow. So I think there is an opportunity for change here. And I think from the electorate point of view, I suspect, you know, they're looking for a lot of change. We've got, it's almost kind of a sort of cycle of industrialization or a cycle of, you know, of development of the economy. But it feels like there are so many areas we need to restructure and change for the good. And, you know, whether that's at an institutional level, whether it's a regulatory level, obviously the government coming to election, the public will determine what needs to happen there. But I think this is a time of, we see it as a period of real change and therefore an opportunity to influence and perhaps, you know, encouraging other organisations that may not have stepped up, they don't see themselves as trade bodies, for example, but to kind of step up and join together to influence for change, I think is a really important thing. I think alongside that, we see, so we're starting to do a lot of engagement across the House with MPs because we think this is cross-party. It should not be for one political party or another. This is cross-party. It's about a long-term plan for the UK. And I think in that we see sort of real opportunities to build that consensus cross-party as well if we're successful. So I think yeah, perhaps just a lot of opportunity. It is a time of change, but we want to, I guess, work with others to accelerate all of that knowledge that we have. And just in terms of the audiences that we're talking to, obviously one of our key audiences is in the MPs, it feels to us like, you know, we've lost a lot of knowledge about industry. The UK used to have 40% of its GDP coming from industry, probably about 40 years ago, certainly in my time as well, in, you know, when I started. And that's diminished over time, I think, as successive governments have focused on perhaps financial services and sectors. And I think we feel there needs to be a rebalancing there. But as part of that, perhaps we all need to be educating a bit more around what that means. You know, what are the core elements and what does that really mean? So, you know, back to my point at the start, that science startups, you know, they take a long time to get to market. They need to be nurtured. They need to be supported. They need to have funding at successive stages. And those funding rounds need to come much more easily than they do today, because they can launch in the UK, but when they get to mid stage, there's just no real funding and available, you know, for them, which is why a lot of them then obviously disappear off elsewhere and get bought out or go and list in the US, for example. So I do think there's a role about sort of education again, Lee, that perhaps we could all work together on.
Cool. Yes. And obviously, you know, that we're entirely up for supporting you in whichever ways we can on this. Do you want to take us through some of the highlights?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, no, absolutely. So so we've got several policy interventions. We deliberately launched with some specifics in there as well, so that we weren't too high level, and we're continuing to work on some of the areas. The first area that we have called for is commitment, really. It's about commitment. So we've called for a Science and Innovation Growth Council. That is not exclusively, but it's heavyweight from business people. And that is because so many of them are not at the table because they're all busy people and diverted and doing other things. But we feel that there needs to be a real drive there, direct line to the PM, a statutory body. And in fact, the Labour Party have actually already come out and said that they would put this in place.
Wow.
That Science Innovation Growth Council would be tasked with making sure that the manifesto and other parts that may come from others, you know, the kind of infrastructure in the environment is put in place to deliver science in value into the UK. And it would also seek to support maybe legislation to provide long-term commitments to an infrastructure and an environment that is supportive, encouraging and attracting in science companies into the UK. So that's kind of quite a key one, because that's about intent. It's about, you know, what we need, and it's about commitment, yeah, you know, post this, whichever government gets in. The next area, which I'm sure you'll be very familiar with, is around R&D tax credits, where we've called for a reversal of the changes that happened recently. And we recently talked to Treasury about this. The changes that came through, the UK was very competitive. I think because of some different issues, which were around potential abuse of the R&D tax credits, they were stepped back quite considerably. And we've called for those that sort of step back to be reversed, whilst the government also addresses the sort of, you know, issue of people accessing them incorrectly. And we've also in there called for an amount to be carved out and highlighted and protected for what we call scale up capital in there, which I'll come on to in a minute. The next area is around scale up capital. And actually, when you look at this, this is where a lot of the startups fail. They just don't get to sort of ton scale and multi-ton scale because they've run out of money, essentially. And so we've been looking at venture capital. The venture capital market in the UK is one of the biggest. It's certainly the biggest in Europe. But the VC money is not going into science startups. It's going into a lot of tech, but not science. So the patient capital piece is not there. There have been some recent changes around pension reform, which you might have seen. We've been calling for pension fund reform to allow those funds to invest in a sensible, measured way into science startups. And really, this is also about what other forms of capital could there be. So we've been talking to the British Business Bank. They've got a consultation at the moment on a new type of funding called LIFTS. Which is about, you know, the kind of scale of intervention at the 5 million to, say, 20 million scale. So within our scale up kind of capital bucket, the concept here is a startup should be able to start up and get access to money for startup, and it should be able to transition into the different various stages of funding in a relatively simple and straightforward way, and there should be funding available all the way through to full scale whether that's full-scale manufacture and they go ahead and just run the business, or whether they go to a listing, which hopefully then would be in the UK. The other area which we've called out is around large-scale investments. So these are, you know, on scale. The classic example perhaps that is quoted is the AstraZeneca announcement recently, that to take a £500 million investment to Ireland because the UK is no longer competitive. And we hear this all the time with the companies we work with all the time. They're investing elsewhere in hydrogen, in battery technologies, in biotech. They're just not investing in the UK anymore because it's not competitive. And that reason for not being competitive is quite complex and needs to be unpicked and addressed in a sensible way. But we have to make the UK a competitive place for large-scale investment. Large-scale investment brings with it a whole host of things. It typically brings with it long-term jobs and valuable jobs. It typically brings with it R&D centres, because often the companies will then put down the scientists and the engineers who are responsible for the kind of scaling up alongside that manufacturer. And that's obviously good for the UK. And often they will then reinvest back into the universities as well. So there's huge amounts of investment going on with the companies that we're dealing with day in, day out, but just not in the UK. And we're saying that needs to change. And then the final area is around the visa system and visa mobility in particular for industrial scientists and engineers. And I think it's just not recognised that they are a kind of core capability set. I think we all know there's great scientists and engineers in academia, but actually the ones in industry bring with them some real know-how deep know-how and knowledge of how to scale new technologies and new science bases. So we're calling for a scheme that would enable companies to take those people to put them in different parts of the globe, whether that's the US or China or wherever, and bring them in and out of the UK in a much more mobile way than happens today. And obviously Brexit, had a big impact on mobility of industrial scientists and engineers as well. So those are the core elements that we're asking for. And as I say, we've had some real traction on some of them already. We believe that they need to happen together. You can't pull one lever and expect everything to work. These are kind of levers that all need to be pulled at the same time, or certainly in sequence. And they're the core elements that will really help drive new investment in the UK, large scale investment in the UK, and startups to flourish.
That's amazingly ambitious, isn't it? Gwilym, what are your thoughts as a UK patent attorney hearing this for the first time?
I'm quite jealous that the physicists don't have one of these. Fantastic.
Gwilym, just join us. This is not a one person or one organisation thing or another. I think we just generally feel quite strongly this is a collaboration.
As you say, you've got the horticulturalists and you've got physicists already. So there's room for us all there, which is brilliant. We also very, obviously not political, but we're also very interested in what's going on in the bigger picture and innovation. If you're passionate about something, it's probably innovation. I think that's where our organisations cross over. Charlotte, I was wondering whether you're educating, if they need any educating at all, SCI about the importance of the patent community, the IP community in the UK, which is world beating in also ensuring that our innovative position stays strong.
Yeah, absolutely. I've spent quite a lot of time talking to people in SCI about patents and IP more generally. It is something that people really do need to have the support about, as well as all these other things that Sharon's saying, and I'm sure you see it as well, Gwilym. Quite often, startups will come to us with some great ideas and stuff they want patenting, but actually they do quite often run out of funding before they're able to get the products to market. And it's always very disappointing when you've written a patent application on a great product and then it just runs out of steam for whatever reasons, some of these things that we're trying to address with this manifesto.
Absolutely. And Sharon, hopefully she's done a great job of convincing you.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think, Gwilym, you'd be pleased to know that the patent attorneys have always been part of our system. In the early days, they were there. I suspect we have a lot of crossover in our early founders. And like you, I think the founders saw the real value in that collaboration. We have examples of our members who I'm sure were members of yours, you know, seeking new legislation, looking at structures for, you know, patenting. This is now in the, you know, late 1800s and into the early 1900s. So I think, you know, this is, you said before that, you know, CIPA isn't a political organization, and we're not either. We're not a trade body. We're very clear about that. We're an independent charity. But back to the point I was making, it would feel this is a really important time of change. We feel it is important for organizations to stand up and have their say, you know, in a way that perhaps we wouldn't normally do, in order to help influence the future. Charlotte's talked about the startups, and we see them, and, you know, we help them start up. She mentioned Cydia. You know, we've had a couple of fabulous startups. You know, one was an Earthshot finalist. Another one's gone off to get, you know, 1.2 million of seed funding. And, you know, we've got some fabulous young scientists with great ideas and real passion for starting things up. But how do we help them on their way? And that's a, you know, the practicality of that is something that perhaps needs to be worked out between organizations like ours, organizations like yours, and funders. You know, how do we all help or think about ways of making sure they don't run out of money? Because we know they're going to need that money. They need a strong patent portfolio. They need a global patent portfolio. Science is global. You can't just have a UK patent portfolio and think you're going to end up with a successful business, you know. So maybe there are things that we could do together to at least put our sort of areas of expertise together to think about, you know, how are there other things that we should be doing or thinking about together?
So I think to help kickstart that, you're coming to CIPA Council in January.
Yes.
Which we're looking forward to.
Thank you very much for the invite. Yep.
Our new president, Matt Dixon, this is very much part of his bag in terms of how he sees his priorities for his presidential year. Yeah, I think we're going to have lots of exciting stuff to talk about at that council meeting.
Yeah, I do too. It's a fascinating time. The UK has a lot of innovators, entrepreneurs. We just need to bring people together. I think there's a lot of passion, there's a lot of goodwill, and there's a lot of people who will give of their time and expertise, but let's make it count in this window that we have.
So one of my only important jobs on the podcast is to try and keep us to time, and we're kind of like thereabouts, but we've got a few more minutes so we can carry on for a wee bit if everyone's okay with that. Sharon, Charlotte, are you sat there thinking, really wanted to get this message across? Are there any unsaids?
Yeah, I quite like to meet. Go on, Charlotte. Yeah.
Okay, I was going to say one thing that I'd quite like to just highlight is you know, one instance where the support that SCI has given to a small company, and then the support the CIPA's given to the same business, how that's sort of matured into something really, really great. I think we're all aware, and I think you've probably done a podcast about the Earthshot Prize, and low carbon materials were one of the shortlisted
one of our nominees.
CIPA nominated them, and actually many years ago, when those and the people who now run low carbon materials were students, they took part in the Bright's Idea competition that SCI run, and they were the winners. At that point they had a different name, didn't they, Sharon? I can't remember what name was, but
yeah, they did. Natasha, we helped sort of launch them. So yeah, out of Durham University, and obviously they've gone on to good things. So yeah, so you're right, Charlotte. There's maybe a connection there. You know, these when we're encouraging them, and we give them training. So we actually train them, Leon, you know, how to pitch, how to write a business plan, how not to run out of cash. And we actually talk to them about patenting as well, risk management, some core skills, and then they come to a final and pitch and go off with some money. And then we, you know, the ones that want to, we put them into our mentoring program, because we've got a lot of entrepreneurs in SCI. But there's an example, Charlotte, you're quite right to call that out, about how we could perhaps work together a bit more, because if that company is then looking to grow, passing them on to you and making sure that they get support from the experts in patenting is a really important next stage of development, isn't it? And we have, you know, we have several of those each year. Yeah.
Sharon, are you an Earthshot nominator?
No, we're not, but we should be.
Absolutely. We must have a conversation on that then, because we
definitely.
I mean, we found ourselves becoming an Earthshot nominator kind of through the back door. We started off by doing IP due diligence, so that was the offer that we made to the foundation. You know, we can take a look at your finalists, your nominees, and just make sure that any you're taking through to the final have their act together in terms of their IP. And it's off the back of that we got we were invited to become a nominator. We are now a super nominator. Oh. And in the year that Charlotte was talking about last year, we had three finalists and one of those was a winner, which was amazing for us. So yeah, we must have a conversation about how we can get SCI into that nominations process.
Definitely, definitely. No, that would be great. That would be great. No, fabulous. So again, you know, I think they were launched as Plus Tech Innovation in 2019. They won our program and then the business obviously developed. But, you know, we have fabulous scientists coming from a whole range of different areas, you know, cardiovascular drugs, treatment of burns.
What about seaweed?
Water shortages. Yeah.
What about seaweed? How many have you got? Because the one thing that Willem and I have found out through this podcast is how exciting the world of seaweed is for future innovation.
Well, we need to send you, we'll put you perhaps on the circulation for Chemistry and Industry, CNIR magazine, because that covers all of these innovations as they're coming forward. I think we covered seaweed probably about 15 years ago in the very early stages. But you're right, you know, all of these areas, back to our horticulture group, you know, are really important in terms of developments going forward. There's lots of exciting stuff. It's a good time to be around, but we need to perhaps just work together to make sure that science is accelerated out of the lab.
Oh, that's a great closing message for the podcast. Thank you for that. Except this doesn't close the podcast because there's something that Gwilym and I do at the end of the podcast, which is generally me, sometimes Gwilym, generally me. We come up with a slightly tangential question just to have a little bit of fun at the end. Mm-hmm. So apologies, you're going to have to join in on this. It always goes to Gwilym first, so you get a little bit of time to think. So I was quite taken by you've said it a number of times, the narrative about taking science out of the lab. But I want to take us back into the lab. Gwilym, what's the most fun you've ever had in a science lab?
There's two things. One really strong memory from when I was a student and I was a bit broke, and they had a really old school hot chocolate machine in the physics lab outside. It's probably about 12p or something, and it came out in a little plastic cup.
Another ones, yeah.
It made me really happy. A very cool experience when I was at school. Actually, we had a laser, and my colleague, who now is literally a rocket scientist, he was amazing as a scientist. He works for the Ariadne, is it the space program? Anyway.
Yeah.
He decided it'd be really interesting to fill a tub of water up until you got the meniscus, you know, the kind of the curve over the top, and bounce a laser off the meniscus, because it occurred to him it might be quite interesting what you got. And it was after we turned the lights off in the room, it was a dark room, we bounced the laser off the meniscus, and it was unbelievable, because you got these interference patterns because of the coherence of the laser and the slow movement of the surface of the
water. I'm so glad I asked.
All around the room, it's psychedelic, these rotating interference patterns. And at one point, there's like a cone going around, and his face just spun round on the cone and then disappeared around the back again. It was one of the most surreal moments. I've never come across it as a scientific discipline, rolling laser beams off menisci.
This may be your greatest answer to a question on the podcast, you know.
I pride myself on being quick to answer your questions, Lee. Yeah. It was a good question, that one. It was a genuinely memorable experience.
And you've given Charlotte plenty of time to think, so let's go to Charlotte next.
Oh, dear. I think I was always very well behaved in the lab and stuck to all the rules. So
we weren't wearing goggles.
I have more fun using my kitchen more like a lab and just not entirely following recipes and seeing how things will work.
Oh, that's the best way to experiment, though, isn't it, with recipes? Recipes and science come together. We've done a podcast on food and science and looking at recipes. It was real fun. So, God, Sharon, you must have misbehaved in a lab. I can't believe that you've never done something.
I did, but I'm not allowed to document it. But yeah, you know, clearly burning and blowing things up, you know, has to be a favorite of any chemist in the lab. Things that just burn and ignite. Perhaps just to take it into an industrial setting, the first company I worked for, it doesn't exist anymore, a company called Albright & Wilson, and they had, their core chemistry was around phosphorus chemistry, which is, you know, spontaneously ignites in air. Or if you don't know, it does spontaneously ignite in air. And there was a very famous story. They were based up in Birmingham, just on the outskirts of Birmingham. There was a very famous story about, which I probably shouldn't say, but this was 40, 50 years ago, about some cows that used to graze on the nearby fields. And the phosphorus used to come all the way from Canada, actually, be shipped over and put into storage vessels underwater to keep it safe. But some of the phosphorus had got into the local canal, and one of the cows had got into the canal think just going to get some water, and decided to go and get some water, have a drink and come out, and spontaneously it exploded. So there was an exploding cow on the fields of on the outskirts of Birmingham. And that's always stuck with me. I mean, that's like your kind of, you know, expression of chemistry, isn't it? It's always going to be blowing things up.
I know.
By the way, we wouldn't do that anymore, by the way. That's for any animal lovers. Yeah. It was not intentional. And certainly that wouldn't happen now. Yeah.
Not in your science garden. What a shame.
Not in the science garden, no. No.
So Lee only ever asks this question because he knows he's got a good one lined up. Lee, do you want to know your answer? I'm a little nervous.
So one of my answers has just been taken because it was about exploding animals, and I'm so pleased I don't have to tell that story now. I'll go to my second best story, which actually happened under a lab rather than in it. So Gwilym knows this because I talk about it on most podcasts. Charlotte and Sharon might not, but I'm a plumber by trade.
I thought you might not get it in on this one.
And I was once called to a leak under a laboratory in Portsmouth, and it was kind of in the local constabulary kind of law bit. And it was a science lab. It was a forensics lab, all of those kinds of things. And it was the first time I'd ever seen glass plumbing. So kind of went underneath this place and all of the parts were glass, and was immediately told that I can only work in there if I had a hazmat suit on. So I had to try and dabble in some fairly complex sort of replacement of joints in glass plumbing systems, wearing what could only be described as something I would wear on the moon, which made it almost physically impossible to use my hands. That's the best story I've got, Gwilym. Not a great one, I know. I think it might have also come up on the Colin Burst podcast, because I think we share that experience. Thank you all for coming on. It's been great fun, but also really serious and important. And I think that's when these podcasts work the best, when we have a little bit of fun, but we cover stuff that that really matters. So and this clearly does. So Sharon, Charlotte, thank you for joining us. Gwilym, I don't know when the next one is, but I'll see you then, mate.
See you soon.